Welcome to Studio 395, a production of the Department of History at James Madison University and its Historical Research Methods course, History 395. I'm your host, sophomore history major Chloe Keefe. In 1922, Japanese immigrant Takao Ozawa was denied citizenship in the United States on the basis that he did not qualify as white. This verdict was the first time that white was used to mean Caucasian by a judicial authority, setting a lasting precedent of American perceptions of race after a period of uncertainty regarding it. Here to discuss with me today how Japanese antagonism shaped the white identity is junior history major Nicholas Mays, who tackles this topic in his paper titled Blumenbach's Legacy, the Creation of a Caucasian Identity Through the Exclusion of the Japanese.
Hello.
Welcome, Nick.
Hi.
Right. So, Ozawa was praised for his patriotism, but denied citizenship to the United States. How is he American, but not so in the eyes of the government?
Well, it's important to understand the racial philosophies of the period. There was in the 18th century, there was a very prominent naturalist, comparative anatomist. His name was Blumenbach. He was a German guy. And he had introduced the idea of there being multiple different kind of categories of races across the world, like Caucasian, Mongolian, that kind of thing. And so in his schema, Mongolian meant all the East Asian peoples. Caucasian meant basically anybody west of the Caucasus Mountains, so Europeans, North Africans even. Mm-hmm. So the problem laid in the fact that Ozawa was a Mongolian, or at least according to these philosophies, he was considered Mongolian. Ozawa as a person was a very, very, very thoroughly assimilated sort of immigrant. He came to America when he was a young man. He attended an American high school. After that, he attended an American university. After that, he got a job working on a sugar plantation in Hawaii. He married a woman who kind of lived in a similar situation to him. She also came to America young and was thoroughly assimilated. He refused to teach his children how to speak Japanese. He sent his children to Japanese schools. So he was a very, very prototypical American man. But the problem was that despite all of that stuff, he was a Mongolian. So in the eyes of the court, in the eyes of the general public, he could never be considered white, mm-hmm. I suppose. Even though a huge portion of the basis of his argument was that he himself was a white man. Like, he had white skin. He was a very pale man, right? He had white skin. And his argument was, well, look at me, basically.
His
I'm white.
His complexion didn't qualify.
Right. Up until this point, the naturalization laws of the United States that had been set in place all the way back in 1790 explicitly said that the only people who could become American naturalized citizens were free white persons. Mm-hmm. And so the problem with that is that there was never any legitimate definition given for what a free white person meant. The law just straight up said just free white person and nothing else. So by the time of Ozawa, there had been this development of this idea that, you know, Caucasian was beginning to mean white and white was beginning to mean Caucasian, but it wasn't necessarily true that that was exactly the mm-hmm. case. And that's where Ozawa's case lied. He tried to say, well, the letter of the law just says free white person and I'm a free white person, so let me have citizenship.
And the government wasn't going to have that, so, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And speaking of the government, what were the relations like between Japan itself and the United States? How did these polities view each other at the time surrounding this issue?
Well, the United States and Japanese relations had actually been very, very strong for the previous 50 years from Ozawa, all the way from the early 1860s up until the early 1910s. Japan saw America as something of a role model. You know, the Japanese government tried to emulate American policies, American ideals in order to develop their country. And in turn, a lot of Americans saw Japanese as something of a younger brother, almost, in the East. Teddy Roosevelt was quoted as calling them the Yankees of the East one time. So there was a very, very positive kind of view between the two nations. But the issues, the wedge was that started to drive between them started to come about in the early 20th century, like in the 1900s. And by the 1900s, I mean the decade of the 1900s. Yeah. So there was a huge influx of immigration from Japan. A lot of Japanese laborers were starting to come over to America to try to, get jobs. They could find better work. They could find better employment opportunities with more money on the line in America than they could in Japan. So a lot of American white laborers started to see that as something of a threat. They were afraid that, these Japanese foreign people basically were starting to come over and that they were going to start taking their jobs, basically.
Just after they had done the Chinese Exclusion Act and they'd gotten rid of the Chinese immigration, like the fear of the Japanese immigration, like taking place of it.
Right, exactly. They didn't miss a beat, basically. Mm-hmm. As soon as the Chinese got excluded, which was 1882, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 1882. The kind of hostility towards the Chinese was almost immediately turned towards the Japanese. Right. So, this hostility was primarily concentrated in the West Coast, because that's where a lot of the Japanese immigrants came. And it actually reached a point such that by 1906 in San Francisco, there was such a outcry amongst white America about Japanese school children being in the same schools as these white people, that they actually pressured the government, the government of California, into ordering a segregation law. Mm. So Japanese school children were actually segregated into Oriental schools. That's what they called them. So that was 1906. And almost as soon as that happened, Japan and the Japanese government, they were outraged highly by this. They were incredibly angered because this was, the first major blow to a very, very positive relationship that they had up until this point. And so Japan started to, there were actually rumors of war starting to swirl around in Japan. So people were, citizens, newspaper writers, all that kind of stuff, they were starting to insinuate that maybe if the United States wanted to play ball that way, then really the only way that they could play the same game was through war, basically. So after all of this, the United States government, Teddy Roosevelt spearheaded this. The United States government agreed to something of an informal arrangement between America and Japan, and they called this arrangement the Gentleman's Agreement. This was 1907, and the idea behind the Gentleman's Agreement was that if the Japanese government stopped issuing passports to Japanese citizens to be able to come to America, then in return, the United States government would prevent segregation, and they would do everything they could to make sure that Japanese citizens, or I should say immigrants, Japanese immigrants that were already in America would be treated with respect and dignity.
So, you've touched on the antagonisms a little bit, like the conflict towards the Japanese people, and I know at the time there was sort of a threat seen in Japan. Would you like to expand on that?
Sure. So, Japan, by the early 1890s, Japan had reached an industrialized point such that they were able to start making military maneuvers in the Pacific and in East Asia. They started trying to assert their own dominance over their neighbors. And so they did that in China. They did that with Manchuria, which, became the Japanese call it Manchukuo.
Mm-hmm.
They did that in Korea. They did that in Taiwan. So they started making these major kind of imperialistic moves in the Pacific. And the biggest challenge that they met came in 1905 when they challenged the Russians to battle. They had the Russo-Japanese War went from 1905 to about 1906. It wasn't a very long war, but it was a war where nobody really expected Japan to beat a Western power in the form of Russia. They thought that Japan was still kind of, behind the eight ball, more or less, on this. And there was in America, there was something of a outpouring of support, actually, for Japan from American citizens. They thought that Japan, by defeating, imperialistic Russia, was somehow going to, bring them honor and liberty and justice and all these kinds of other traditional American values for, even though, you know, this is an entirely different country, this is an entirely mm-hmm. different people and society, it was strange, but Americans supported the Japanese war effort. Until 1906, in the Battle of Tsushima, which was probably the worst naval defeat in the entirety of the 20th century, the Japanese absolutely destroyed the Russian fleet at the Strait of Tsushima, and kind of asserted their official dominance. They, you know, this was the first time that a East Asian power had defeated a Western one in the modern era.
And it was a big show of power that they were not expecting.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Nobody expected Japan's navy to be so well-developed and well-advanced. And so as soon as that happened, American support, like, flipped on a dime, basically. Immediately people started fearing, you know, this East Asian power that suddenly showed that it could hang with the big boys, you know? It could sink an entire fleet in a day. It could do all this other stuff. And, in fact, there was this German newspaper article that outright said, this is not just a crushing blow for Russia. This is a crushing blow for the entirety of the white race. You know, white men need to arm themselves against the yellow victor as soon as possible. Just crazy stuff like that. That article, even though it was German, it got recirculated in American newspapers all across the country. So there was this strange, almost overnight change in feeling from Americans towards the Japanese.
How do these standards that we mentioned differ or are similar for Bentaro Kumagai, who's also denied, but his case occurred right after the Gentleman's Agreement around this time, whereas Ozawa's occurred later in 1922. So how is that different or similar?
Right. So Bentaro Kumagai was also a Japanese immigrant who was looking for citizenship, but his case was in 1908, whereas Ozawa's was 1922. Kumagai was actually an honorably discharged soldier of the United States Army. So he was trying to apply for citizenship based on a law that had been put in place after the Civil War that allowed, you know, discharged soldiers to attain citizenship. However, he also was denied because he wasn't white. But the difference in this case was kind of the wording of the verdict. In Ozawa's case, they outright said, "You are not a free white person because you are not a Caucasian." In Kumagai's case, they said, "We're not going to give it to you because we don't think that you constitute a white person, and we're trying to hold the line of demarcation between the races that Congress, the races that are predominant in this country that Congress had set back in 1790. So there is a bit of a subtle difference in the wording here where, in Ozawa's case, they were very, very blunt. They were very outright, and they said, "No, you're not Caucasian. You can't have it." Kumagai's case, they didn't go out of their way to say what the predominant race was. They just wanted to say, "Well, you're not white." So this was, it seems like this was a way to kind of prevent hostility in the wake of this whole gentleman's agreement kind of thing happening. They didn't want to like inflame tensions. They didn't want to pick at a wound that was already still kind of sore. So they didn't want to outright say, "Well, you're not Caucasian. You're Mongolian. So you can never be an American."
And create more conflict with Japan, who just showed their like abilities. So
right, exactly.
Yeah. And how did Ozawa's case set a precedent for whiteness in America and future cases on this issue?
In today's legal parlance, Caucasian still means white.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you ask anybody on the street, you know, what is a Caucasian person, they most likely tell you it's a white person, it's a white American. That was, you know, the phrasing, you know, the idea of a Caucasian person being a white person was still kind of a popular idea even back in Ozawa's time, but it wasn't until this case that it actually became, mm-hmm. you know, legally binding. Like, that became the actual terminology for
Blumenbach's color code became official.
Right, exactly. So I guess you could say that is what Blumenbach's legacy is. You know, today this idea of a Caucasian race is really only limited to white people, you know.
Yeah.
Right.
And the government cemented this through his case.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you for joining me today and having this discussion, and thank you for listening to Studio 395. More interviews on a wide range of historical topics and subscriptions to our podcast are available on our show page at sites.lib.jmu.edu/studio395. To learn more about the history major at James Madison University, please visit www.jmu.edu/history. Thank you.
Thank you.